Dorothy Day, someone who you may have heard of before. I met her here at Holden for the first time when I ran across a little book, called Dorothy Day, which is just full of a lot of sayings that she has said over the years or have been written down. And in a film that we had one year called Excuse Me, America, in which she had a small little portion and they were interviewing her. And here was a woman at that time, almost 80 years old, talking with her conviction. And I thought, my word, that woman is strong. And those of us who are women know that we could use a few models like that. I think women are generally strong, but we don't have the public leadership as a rule that we need to have. So I was very fascinated by Dorothy and just kind of kept her in the back of my mind and looked at things that she said and wrote over the years. And then last year, which was my senior year in seminary, some of us are very old when we start, I thought I had an opportunity in a class that I was working with to read more about Dorothy. So I got all the books I could out of Catholic seminary, all of which were not quite enough. I see we have two more here at the bookstore that look pretty interesting to me. And I read and I read and I read about Dorothy Day. And so it seemed only useful to use it up here at Holden. Dorothy, as the notes on the board say, was born in 1897 and died in 1980. So she had a good long life. Her picture is here on a poster that you can buy in the bookstore. And you might like to just come up and look at it. You know, when you look at her picture, especially this one, she really looks cross and forbidding to me. She was not a pretentious woman in any way. But she had depth that most of us don't encounter in our lifetimes. One of the interesting books that I read that went very quickly and is also in our bookstore that you might like to see is called A Year at the Catholic Worker. And it was written by a man by the name of Mark Ellis, and I'll tell you a little more about him later. Dorothy was, lived in her adolescent years in Chicago. So she was a city person, and she used to walk West Side Chicago, which meant that she was walking through the neighborhoods where all the stockyards, workers were. And if you ever read The Jungle or one of those books, you know that it was really terrible there. And people lived very inhumane lives. And she had a little brother and she'd walk him in the stroller and they'd look at all this. And Dorothy was perceptive enough to know that this isn't the way it's supposed to be. She hadn't been raised in a strongly religious family. She had religious ties. Her family did have church ties. She was quite fascinated by one of her friend's mothers, who was an active Catholic. And one day, they had these kind of homes where you had to walk through every other room to get to the one behind in those days, and she burst in one day on this mother in prayer and was quite struck by that and tucked it away in her mind. But as she was growing, she could see the difference between how people behaved and what they talked about in terms of their faith. And it was a jarring thing to her, and she wanted to confront that at all times. What I've done in preparing this is my usual. I have written some poetry. So from time to time, I'll just read to you some of those poems that came out of my readings, as well as some of the quotations that come from Dorothy's literature. Hers was a call to write. Born a Christian in 1897, daughter of a newsman, devoted older sister, curious about the faith, she told stories about events and people. At 16, she walked the streets of the jungle, West Side Chicago, and came to know what it meant to be poor, oppressed, powerless. She declared the church uncaring, self-concerned, disregarding the miseries of the world, waiting for an afterlife. The church which she desired and nurtured lived a life now alien to her. For many years, she consciously left it behind. It was, of course, a loss for the church that Dorothy chose not to be a Christian for a period, an extended period of her life. "I was tearing myself away from home," she said, "living my own life, and I had to choose the world to which I wanted to belong. I did not want to belong to the Epworth League, which some of my classmates joined. As a little child, the happy peace of the Methodist who lived next door appealed to me deeply. Now, that same happiness seemed to be a disregard of the misery of the world." I think that quote happens to come from her book, The Long Loneliness, which is also in our library, in our bookstore. I like that book quite a bit. It's an autobiographical book. At that time, you know, we had some interesting things going on in this country and around the world. The Bolsheviks were rising, the labor unions were developing, and Dorothy was watching to see how those kinds of things affected people. "There are nowhere," she said, "sufficient housing facilities right now, and I'm writing in 1917. When I think of the human suffering, the terrible amount of energy needed to move even infinitesimally toward a more decent life, I'm amazed at human patience." Each of the radical groups had its own vision, and each was terrified that immediate gains would make the masses content and not willing to go further toward the new earth they were envisioning. Socialism was too doctrinaire. I could not understand Marx. The IWW had an immediate program for America, so I signed up with them. She also noticed this. The Marxists, the IWWs, who looked upon religion as the opiate of the people, who thought they had only this one life to live and then oblivion, they were the ones who were eager to sacrifice themselves now and for all eternity. They were fighting to obtain for their brothers, God love them. She could see that they were more willing to sacrifice than, shall we say, we, the Christians. Peter Morin was a very important person in Dorothy's life. I know less about Peter, but he's referred to so often as an adjunct to her. But it was his vision that captured her. Peter was, however, an unorganized kind of person, and Dorothy had this pragmatic organizational way about her, and so they made an excellent combination, because Peter could go off talking and lecturing to people and telling them about what was a sort of utopian dream. And it was Dorothy who would say, "Now here's how we're going to pull that off. Here's what we're going to do." And it was helpful. They made a good team for a long time. Peter Morin believed in a green revolution, not red, when all would live and be productive on the land. "To give and not to take, this is what makes man human." That's a quote from him. A social doctrine of the common good, utopian Christian communism, private property with responsibility. Hoe in hand between rows of beans, he lectured friends on his communitarian farms, on charity, on employment, decentralization. One must give up one's life to save it. Voluntary poverty, starting poor. A man with a dream. He needed a realist and someone to write his dream. He found Dorothy. You see, he did want to have everyone move back to the land if possible. You remember Dorothy was a city person. This was one of their differences. And he did start Mary House and these kinds of communitarian farms. But a lot of people who were attracted to those kinds of ideals tended to be intellectual, and they didn't like hoeing beans in the field. It was kind of a tough job to get them organized and not competitive. And Dorothy writes very humorously about some of that stuff. I enjoy her writings about it. It was mentioned sometime this week that there was at one time a march in Washington. That's not new stuff. I guess I always thought that was kind of 60s stuff, you know, or at least 30s, late 30s or something. Well, anyway, there was a march in Washington, and Dorothy was there covering it for a newspaper because she had been a newswoman. You know, that was kind of ahead of her time, wasn't it? She's writing for newspapers in the 20s. She has given up by that time Christianity. She had a common law marriage. But she was always kind of in struggle. I mean, she used to be out late at night, she writes, with her friends drinking and having a good time. And then on the way home, she'd stop at some Catholic parish and say some prayers for the poor or whatever. So she was always kind of pulled and drawn in that direction. But she couldn't affirm it because she couldn't affirm the behavior that she witnessed in the church. Well, so she was covering this march in Washington. And I thought these were some of these words I remember some of her best. I watched that ragged horde and thought to myself, these are Christ's poor. He was one of them. He was a man like other men, and he chose his friends amongst ordinary workers. These men feel they have been betrayed by Christianity. Men are not Christian today. If they were, this sight would not be possible. Far dearer in the sight of God, perhaps, are those hungry, ragged ones than all those well-fed Christians who sit in their homes, cowering in fear of the communist menace. I felt that they were my people, that I was part of them. I had worked for them and with them in the past, and now I was a Catholic, so could not be a communist. I could not join this united front of protest, and I wanted to. Now she has converted, and she's caught the other direction, you see. Now she feels she has to abandon the workers in order to be part of the church. The Feast of the Immaculate Conception was the next day, and I went out to the National Shrine and assisted at Solemn High Mass there. And the prayer I offered up was that someday, some way would be shown me. Some way would be opened up for me to work for the poor and the oppressed. When I got back to New York, Peter Morin was at the house waiting for me. Ooh, I get goosebumps. And they talked, and they developed this notion, and Peter wanted to make a newspaper called The Catholic Worker. I got this out of our reference room over here, because it still exists today, and now I'm going to be on the list. They've just developed a new logo on top. It used to have it's sort of just a man, a worker, you know, with a big hammer or something. It kind of looked communist. You know, we have to be so careful of that word. At any rate, they've just recently changed the logo. And if you could see this a little more closely, the worker is still there, but now he's black. And Jesus is in the middle. And to the side of Jesus is a woman who is carrying loaves, I believe. She's carrying food. And your wife mentioned to me that she is, oh yes, and she has a child on her back. So that's a new image for the Catholic worker. One of my only disappointments in Dorothy is that she is so sexist and always was. And part of that, I think, came from the fact that she had to choose between the church and that marriage, that common law marriage. She wanted that child to be baptized and part of the church, and her husband was absolutely atheistic, if there is such a thing, and refused to be part of the church. So she had to make that choice. And so she chose the church and baptizing the child, and she raised that child, but she had to leave the marriage. And so she was sort of stubborn about women's roles and thought that most of us, our place was in the home. And if we were Christian, that's what we ought to do. That, at least that's speculation about why she felt that way. And she was very dogmatic about that. And of course, writing in the times in which she wrote never changed her sexist language, and so it's all over the place in her writings, which is hard for me now. Sometimes I just kind of have to sigh when I hear another man for the word human or whatever. Well, Dorothy and Peter got together and began to organize the Catholic Worker, handing it out at big rallies in the middle of New York, 50,000 copies at a time, for free or for a penny, to the workers who had never been ministered to in this way by members of the church. And so that kind of gathered together a lot of interesting people who would work for them. Everything was volunteer. Everything. And getting their finances together was always haphazard. It was always an act of trust and faith. And in time, they developed what were called hospitality houses. Sometimes I tell a true story of destitution when she's writing, but most often I retell biblical stories which are imbued with a grace that touches the heart and turns the eyes to God. The story of the importune widow, a friend who came to borrow an extra loaf for his guest. They observed that that kind of biblical understanding didn't exist. Hospitality is absolutely basic to the Old Testament, as you know, but it's sort of missing in the daily life of ourselves. And Peter Morin referred to what we have now. He said, so hospitality, like everything else, has become commercialized, which you know if you've ever tried to get here without staying overnight someplace at a motel. And their notion was this, that if we all did our own job where we are in terms of hospitality and caring for people, we wouldn't need even the institutional ways of dealing with this, the Christian institutional ways. The first unit of society is the family. The family should look after its own, and in addition, as the early fathers said, every home should have a Christ room in it so that hospitality may be practiced. The coat that hangs in your closet belongs to the poor. If your brother is hungry, it's your responsibility. A real sense of connection to all people. Why don't you come on up to the microphone for a minute and talk a little bit while I tell people. Hospitality houses are a place where people gather, and they exist all across the country now, and were originally founded by Dorothy and Peter. And I don't know your name. John Bransky, whose wife is also one of our interpreters and was leading last night in the Alleluias. They have a direct connection with hospitality houses. Would you like to tell us about it a little?
We are part of the Catholic Worker community in Portland, Oregon. I just wanted to mention one thing. Mary House came later. St. Joseph's House was the first. There are about 50 maybe Catholic Worker communities in the country. I think there's a list of them in this issue of the Worker. The May issue is the anniversary issue. The Worker was founded officially in, if anything is official about the Catholic Worker, it was founded in 1933 in May 1st, May Day. And if you have a chance to scan this newspaper, you might find a community in your own hometown. There are communities in Minneapolis and Chicago, New York, Rochester, New York, all over the Southwest, L.A., Seattle, Portland. There's several in Iowa. There are quite a few in Iowa, as a matter of fact. Davenport, I think, has one. And, pardon me. What we have tried to do is precisely what, in our particular community, and each community is different, what we have tried to do is precisely what that quote that you just read on the family coming first. We do have a Christ room in our house. We don't run a hospitality house in the sense that they do in New York, where you have maybe 25 or 30 hospitality guests coming in, and in some cases, like at Mary House, where they stay for a rather long period of time. But we just have space enough with our family and all to provide a room maybe or two for a small family or for individuals. And this is what we do. they're referred to us primarily through word of mouth contact, people who are working in some of the social service agencies. A lot of people who come to the Catholic Worker as guests are people that the welfare department and some of our religious charitable institutions can no longer deal with. They're people who are basically at the end of the line, and the end of the line in many ways is the Catholic Worker. So that's how we get some of our referrals. Also people just find their way to the door. Either they're hungry or they need a place to stay or whatever, and so they are welcome in our home. The idea being we take personal responsibility for the care of our brothers and sisters, that we don't rely on state institutions or even religious institutions to do this, but they are our brothers and sisters. And so therefore, it is our responsibility to see to it that they have shelter and the food, of course, and a sense of dignity. And actually, Peter Morin used to say that the poor are ambassadors of Christ. And what he meant by that, and this is very interesting to me, is that really we don't serve the poor in the Catholic Worker, but the poor really serve us. They give us the opportunity to connect with the gospel, particularly the Sermon on the Mount, which I think would provide the basis for the Catholic Worker philosophy, so that we are constantly being tested by Christ through these people, the unwashed, the street people, the alcoholics, people that nobody really cares for, people on the margin, to welcome them and as brothers and sisters. So it's really a ministry to us rather than a ministry from us to them. And it's a little bit more, it's not very humble to say this maybe, but it's a little bit more humbling to look at it that way, that we're being ministered to. I don't know what else you want me to say.
That's great.
But,
okay. Carol has a question.
Oh, yeah. It's open-ended. Generally, we try to start with a week or two and then kind of see where things are at. There, we have no real criteria. Yeah. We do some advocacy work. It depends on the situation. I would say that it would be probably in our case, it would be quite unusual for someone to be around longer than a few months. But in some cases, we have had people who have been with us for 2 or 3 months, then have gone on and gotten themselves together and then got untogether and came back. So a lot of times some of our guests come back. And they become friends, actually, and a part of our family. And around Thanksgiving or Christmas time, we'll have all of these people come and share dinner with us. Yes? Well, not in every case. This is the way we do it in Portland. In New York and in L.A., it's much more, I hate to use the word, but it's a much more institutional kind of setting where you'll have a staff and you'll have maybe space for 25 or 30 people. And they're a little bit more chaotic. Because we are a family, we have to kind of keep some semblance of structure in our home. So we aren't able to do it that way. We have little children and so on, which I think is also beneficial to our guests. People seem to act a little bit differently when they're around kids. So the kids are a great gift to our guests as well. But that's the way we do it in Portland. Other communities do it differently. There's a community just north of Chicago, I think it's in Waukegan, which provides long-term hospitality for mentally and physically disabled children. There are communities that deal primarily with men. There are communities that deal primarily with women and children. Redwood City, California Catholic Worker is for teenagers who have run away or who are left by their parents someplace. And so that's where they can go. Yes, ma'am. Well, it's supported by donations, and we are not tax exempt, so because we believe that if people do want to support something like this, that they will make an outright gift rather than feel as though we're some kind of a way to to get something in return. What we try to do in Portland is do it on our own steam. We all work, and we share from what we make, so that we don't rely very heavily on donations. Our soup kitchen, part of also the worker community, is the establishment of soup kitchens around the country, and we do have a soup kitchen in Portland, and it is supported somewhat by donations from outside of ourselves. People just come to know, and so we have one woman that'll, you know, send us a dollar a month from her Social Security check, you know, and so that kind of thing. But basically, we try to share from what we earn ourselves. Well, it started out as a lay Catholic in the Roman Catholic Church sense movement, but it had no clerical or official approval from the various archdioceses or dioceses. It has become increasingly ecumenical over the last 20, 25 years, what with the Ecumenical Council in the 1960s and the opening up of dialogue between the various denominations. So there are many more people involved in the Catholic worker that are not Catholic than there were perhaps in Dorothy Day's early time. But it is connected in the sense of its relationship to the Catholic Church, to the one that is not the small C, but the large C. So, and Dorothy herself was very much Orthodox in that sense. She said if the bishop ever asked her to close down the House of Hospitality, she would do it. So she was very much a person who was Orthodox in that sense. But I think nowadays there, with the younger generation of Catholic workers and so on, there's a little bit more of an open-mindedness and accepting of the different things. Another reaction that I think she had to her early life, and which is why she became so Orthodox, is that she also had an abortion. And when she did become a Catholic, she, I think, bore a lot of guilt in the backdrop of what the Catholic Church has always taught about abortion. So I think, and often converts are a little bit more Orthodox than cradle Catholics, so, which is rather strange. She has a quote that talks about how cradle Catholics ought to be more Orthodox. Well, sure.
That's very helpful. That brought up a couple things to my mind, too. We can probably feed each other here all along. One of the things that Peter Morin and Dorothy never believed in was usury. And I was reminded of that earlier today again, because they didn't think even 1% was right. Peter was known to have said, time belongs to God, not bankers. It's interesting. The poor come for hospitality. Who are the poor? The woman who sleeps with her husband on abandoned slum fire escapes until her baby is due. Then she comes to Dorothy. An alcoholic, released mental patient, distraught, abused child, suicidal woman, all of them unmanageable, unwanted. They are sent to Dorothy. The poor are those with little to live for and less to eat, from Pittsburgh, Chicago, and right down the New York street, the seamen on strike, the children of Harlem who have never before seen a farm. No questions asked at this house. No checkout time, no charge. Only kindness and the request to be fair and respectful of others. Hospitality. Dignity for the world's poor. It's very important in the hospitality houses, and I particularly note the New York one, that people are given dignity. They're treated like real human beings, normal human beings, even though their behavior sometimes is what we would call very abnormal. And people, you know, live up to very often the manner in which they are treated. There was always room, there was always enough for one more. Everyone just take a little less. How long since any of us have really lived that way? Our poverty is not a stark and dreary poverty, this is Dorothy speaking, because we have the security of living together, which living together brings. But it is that living together that is often hard. Beds crowded together, much coming and going, people sleeping on the floor, no bathing facilities, only cold water. These are the hardships. Poverty means lack of paint. It means bed bugs, cockroaches and rats, and the constant war against these. Poverty means body lice. Poverty means lack of soap and Lysol and cleaning powders. And she never glamorizes all of that. She never says it's easy to get along with all of the people who are there. Someone asked her, but won't people take advantage? Isn't that the question we ask when we welcome strangers into our home? The Catholic worker response was, of course. And don't we take advantage of God? Cannot we put up with others? Does not God put up with us? We draw up our standards measuring worthiness of God's children based on our values of time, utility, productivity, gratitude, and return. Dorothy disagreed. In the face and hands and even the contempt of any person, she saw the opportunity to work for God. God's standards are not like our own. We realize when we calculate the worth of people, we become the poor. One day last summer, writes Dorothy, I saw a man sitting down by one of the piers, all alone. He sat on a log, and before him was a wooden box on which he had spread out on a paper his meager supper. He sat there and ate with some pretense of dignity. And it was one of the saddest sights I have ever seen. So for all of Dorothy's intensity and her ability to be practical, she had a whole sensitive side in which she could paint pictures for people of what it was to be poor and how it was to live that way and what the lack of dignity feels like and how it affects people. Living together is not easy. Too many differences, politics, hygiene, sleep schedules, and the mysterious prejudices of one against another. She can tell just horror stories of people who, you know, people who hated each other because of their race or because of their religion and so on, all living together. And they never forced upon the people a particular religious point of view either. And I'm speaking more out of the hospitality house in New York now, but always had vespers or matins or whatever it was. They had their own worship, and they'd go to worship at the parish nearby. And people could come if they wished, but they never even necessarily asked people to come. There was no pressure in any way to become part of the faith. Humanity is human, not divine. We are held together in spite of ourselves. It is not our will, self-interest, decisions, or even our dreams which do it. It is the transcendent, the unseen, the love of God. It's a very spiritual person. People come to join us in our wonderful work. It all sounds very wonderful, but life itself is a haphazard, untidy, messy affair. Unless we can live simply, unquestioningly, and solitary, one might say, in the midst of a mob, then we cease to be a personalist. The more we live with people in a community, the more we must look to ourselves and regard the beam in our own eyes. And that's so true if we think about it in just normal terms of our family lives or our daily lives, that we all kind of think everybody should have their own bedroom. And if things are getting rough around the house, what do we do but retreat from one another to one of those quiet places of the house? And we think we deserve it. And we think it's necessary to survive. And Dorothy's taking that whole concept and just turning it right upside down and saying you don't know yourself until you're in community. And that's one of the things that happened to Mark Ellis. He was a person who was a student who lived, who went to school in Miami. And Mark was a Jew. And he was looking for some sort of mission. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. And he was working on a master's degree. And Dorothy came and spoke. And so he approached her and asked her, you know, well, what did she think he ought to do? And the writer of the book says, probably Dorothy told him that he ought to feed the poor, because she was always very direct in that way. And so he went on his own up to the Catholic Worker and made out of it a thesis by studying day to day, writing day to day on his experiences there for one whole year. And the transformation of this man is the most interesting thing I've read in a long time. As he, and is very honest, he really paints the picture of what it was like. It was very unpleasant there in terms of the kinds of people they saw. Oh, I didn't bring something. The kinds of ugliness that exists on the Bowery of people who are absolutely the rejects of the world, and how they would come in and how they would be violent and be met by people who live there in total nonviolence. What a struggle it was for him to come there and be a part of that and watch this. And he's not a Christian besides. So that was hard for him to even understand. But he learned, I think, about Christianity by being there. That was his touch point. And it affected him profoundly. I hope I can remember the dates here. I won't be able to do that. Here's one thing that Mark writes. He was traveling in the countryside. He had a couple days off from New York. Out of the silence came Jesus, the Word. In the confusion of division and diversity came Jesus, the Unity. I was walking in the desert, weren't you? And there in the distance, in the haze and mists of desert life, stood Jesus, the Healer. He was preaching to the rocks, singing to the winds. He was creating the loaves, multiplying the softness. He was gazing out into the distance, talking to the clouds. He was feeling the roundness of the earth, at peace, crying. See what was happening to him? Nobody ever asked him to come to worship. And I can't say to you that when he left, he became a Christian either. Dorothy's concept of the kingdom was different than ours. I get real impatient with our notions about the kingdom because we tend to put it into the afterlife and into some sort of a distant, untouchable, impossible, utopian kind of notion. And Dorothy helps us get in touch with what the kingdom might really mean. And what would you say of the kingdom, Dorothy? That it means peace. And so we parade for peace and go to jail even in the 40s because we believe in peace. And when we give to the poor and stand with them and pray with them, for them, we have peace, even in the midst of putrid smells and crowded halls. The kingdom is not only to come, but it is to be here among us when we glimpse Christ in the tears of humiliation. He was humiliated. And the love of giving. He gave all. In the promise of freedom, he lifted the oppressed. We do not bring the kingdom, but find it along the streets and back alleys of cities and mines. We find the kingdom when we walk the way. Mark Ellis concluded in his book, "The Catholic Worker has continued over the years to believe in the transforming power of love and service. It has done so during the purges in the Soviet Union, the death camps in Nazi Germany, and the war in Vietnam. To some, perhaps even to a majority, this vision of transforming love, drawn amidst the background of hatred and violence, seems simplistic and romantic. Indeed, the world has chosen other paths to travel. For 45 years, however, the Catholic Worker has offered its vision of a more human society. After having witnessed the transformation myself, I know I can never dismiss the vision of love. Dorothy also worked for peace, as I mentioned, and ended up in jail, and was so sensitive to what she found there, in terms of the kinds of things that were happening to the women in jail, for example. She was a peace advocate right down to the last days, carrying her placards through the Vietnam struggle and afterwards. She represents for me someone who really knew how to live, who wasn't afraid to take some chances and move out into life and poverty and whatever else it was. And so for me, from time to time, I can say, come on, Dorothy, give me a little energy. Give me some direction. Help me do what I need to do. I hope the same for you. Would you like to ask some more questions? Okay, the Catholic Worker is, yes, started and was a newspaper. Then it has become the identification of an organization, which takes some different forms in different places. No, because it is so different. To repeat for the sake of the tape that it is basically a movement that began as a newspaper and now has, I like your description of it as being anarchical because it has its own personality in different places. Loaves and Fishes, which may exist in your cities, has its ties with the Catholic Worker movement. Do any of you have that in your cities? Maybe your churches go and provide food in such places. Say her name again so I can put it on tape. Catherine DeHewick. There are dozens of stories to tell about, in terms of financing, of the Catholic Worker being right up against the wall or a hospitality house being ready to close down because they couldn't pay the rent and somebody coming with the check for the amount, never having asked anyone. Those kinds of things just kind of stun you, you know. You don't forget them. Her connection with the Catholic Church. I wonder if you, when she converted, can you talk better about that, Johnny? Even when she describes it in her own autobiographical material, she's a little vague, I think. Why don't you use the microphone?
I don't know if you're familiar with Commonweal, but it's probably as old as the Christian Century magazine, which you probably are familiar with. She was writing some stories for them, and they're kind of a liberal, it's kind of a liberal magazine, which probably isn't a good term nowadays. But at any rate, the editor, James O'Gara, I think was his name, was the person who actually turned Peter Morin on to Dorothy Day. Peter was met O'Gara, and O'Gara said to him, "I think you would like to meet this woman," and that's, I think, how the story actually happened. So somewhere in the late 20s or so, she must have made her official conversion.
Go ahead. Oh, does she talk about an inward journey prior to her conversion? Oh, yes. Very much she would isolate herself and meditate and so on. And I think that's what she's saying. You don't live in community unless you have that ability to go inside yourself as well and look at that. And even when she wasn't part of the church, I think she was doing that.
She went to Mass.
Yes, daily Mass. Or obedience might be the word that might underlie a lot of this. But we aren't very hierarchical, and we don't like to be obedient too well. I mean, our whole theology kind of mitigates against some of that idea.
I would say that just as it started, it's just a matter of doing it. It's that simple. I mean, I don't think there really is any rite of passage through which one has to go, other than our own relationship to the Gospels, which we've heard a lot of good things this week. While I've been here, I've heard a lot of good things about the Sermon on the Mount and being responsible to your brother and sister. Well, I'm not being critical. I'm just simply saying that those, that's it. That's the, you know, that's the basis. And, you know, I was sitting in a bar one day with a friend of mine, and we were just having, we hadn't visited for a while, and we were having a pitcher of beer, and this fellow came up to us, and he was all bloody, and he was quite drunk, and he said he had just come in he on a boxcar on a train into Portland. I think he was coming up from California somewhere, and this was a real eye-opener to me. And he said he got robbed, which often happens. Some other hobos or whatever robbed him and beat him up, and I don't know how he wound up in this bar, but he came up to us and he asked us first for a cigarette, so I gave him a cigarette. He was sitting over there, and then he came up to us and he wanted some bus fare to go to the drop-in center, which is run on our Skid Row. It's a more institutional kind of setting, but every city probably has one, a municipal type of shelter. So I said, well, rather than, it was getting quite late, I said, rather than give you bus fare, I'll just drive you over there. And it was pretty late. When we got there, people were already sleeping on the sidewalk outside. So the inside had been full. And it was cold and rainy, and I just thought to myself, well, I can't leave him here. So I took him home and gave him a bed at home. So that's basically, you know, but I kept doing this thing, you know, like I thought about giving him the cigarette, and that was cool, and then he left me alone, you know, and then he asked for the bus fare, and I thought, well, at least I'll give him a ride, you know, I don't have to. So I went a little bit further, and then finally there was, I didn't want to leave him out on the street, and then it became very clear to me that I couldn't do that, and so I took him home, and I think that's how it starts. There's no real, you know, placing of the hands or whatever.
And although I think, Herman, some of your question is an institutional question. And we do, I mean, if I've been around the seminary long enough to know that we just hear all the time we ought not work our way into heaven. And so we have to be, so we kind of are cautious about whether we're doing works, righteousness kinds of things, rather than genuine response to God kinds of things. But if you listen to Dorothy, she's responding to God. She's not works righteous, I don't think at all. I think it is taking that first dangerous step and just risking something and going for it. And I think her humility remains because she is always in meditation. And for us, maybe that's what we need, to get a book that's Dorothy's writing, such as this little one, and read it once in a while, just kind of keep ourselves aware so that we come into some sort of spiritual harmony with that kind of thinking. We also are a very upper middle class church, in my opinion. And I think that makes a huge difference. When we talk about stewardship, one of our main things that we get into trouble with at our church is, well, we shouldn't have fundraising projects because then people won't give as much in their pledges, right? I mean, and there's a lot of merit to that kind of thinking. But sometimes what we do is we stifle what might be an outward expression on the part of some person, which would take a different form, but could be called stewardship as well. And as a middle-class church, we deal with people who look like us and live in our suburbs and seem like us, and we do tend to walk away from the needs of the poor, which the Catholics couldn't do so well in 1930. Maybe to close, I can remember, without directly quoting Mark Ellis, who sat and looked at a group of men who were at the hospitality house looking for soup in the morning or noon, each of them sitting alone, all of them dirty, some of them no teeth, some of them just with their heads hanging down, just a decrepit human beings because life had wasted them so in some way and bruised them so much. And then all of a sudden he said, but are these not Christ's poor? Can we not say that Christ is sitting among them? Is not one of those men Jesus Christ himself? If we can have that kind of vision and that kind of connection with people, it helps us. I think it helps us become more open to service and to reach out. So, Oh, no, no, Dorothy's not sentimental. No way. Did you have something you wanted to read there to close?
Maybe you could read it. I like this quote because I think it kind of...
One up on the left?
Yeah.
No one asked us to do this work. The mayor of the city did not come along and ask us to run a bread line or a hospice to supplement the municipal lodging house. Nor did the bishop or cardinal ask that we help out the Catholic charities in their endeavor to help the poor. No one asked us to start an agency or an institution of any kind. On our responsibility, because we are our brother's keeper, because of a sense of personal responsibility, we began to see Christ in each one that came to us. If a man came in hungry, there was always something in the icebox. If he needed a bed, we were crowded. There was always a quarter around to buy a bed on the Bowery. If he needed clothes, there were our friends to be appealed to, after we had taken the extra coat out of the closet first, of course. It might be someone else's coat, but that was all right, too. You may want to learn more about Dorothy Day and her contribution.